Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you're interested in more of our great content, consider signing up for our free newsletter, In Brief. Look for the link in our show notes. Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Well, here we are, 100 days into the second Trump administration, and there's no better person to help us understand what voters are making of these first months of Trump 2.0 than Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson. Kristen's a founding partner of Echelon Insights, an opinion research and analytics firm. She's a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and an on-air political contributor at CNN. Quick disclaimer, we taped this conversation on Thursday, April 24th, before the flurry of day 100 polls were released over the weekend. That's why you won't hear me asking her about a specific or many specific polls. But the reason I wanted to have Kristen on in the first place was that I didn't want to get caught up in these immediate set of data. I wanted Kristen to do what she does best, which is to filter the signal from the noise, present a 30,000 view of the political environment rather than focusing on the minutiae or just small movements in data. What I like about Kristen so much, and I'm hoping you will too, is that she's able to toggle seamlessly between reading crosstabs, in other words, the minutiae in the data, but also probing voters in focus groups, really listening in to what they are saying or not saying, and then explaining it to regular people in a way that is approachable, but not condescending. That's why I was especially excited to talk with her about a presidency as complicated and unprecedented as Trump's. Here's our conversation. Hello, Kristen Soltis Anderson.
Hello, Amy Walter.
I am so excited to have you on. You are one of my favorite people, and you help decipher the world in a way that I think is so smart and thoughtful, but approachable, which is why you were the perfect guest for the 100 Days In podcast. But before we get into all of the data and the analysis that you do, I sort of wanted to step back and have a more existential question for you about how you approach data. And I think, especially now at this time where there's so much polling out there, people are talking about it in conversations, you know, they're not necessarily political people, but they have data in front of them now more than ever. I want you to help sort of demystify polling and what it does and doesn't tell us, how you approach looking at the data, how you approach the answers you get from voters, and what it can really tell us.
So I love what I do in the polling industry because my job is to be a good listener. That's the number one thing that as a pollster, you should be aiming for at all times. My job is to put interesting questions out there, see what I get back, and try not to put too much of what I want it to say or what I think it should say. Try not to put too much of that into how I'm approaching things. And so for me, what I think is a valuable way for someone who is not a pollster by trade, but is consuming this stuff. Occasionally a poll will pop up in their feed on social media somewhere and they try to know what to make of it. I always caution people, one, if you see a number that confirms exactly what you think voters should be feeling, be cautious. There are probably other data points out there that tell a different story. And no one data point is going to be the whole story, I think is the number one thing that is, it's hard to do because usually if I do a TV segment or if something goes viral, it's because there's a number that's making everybody freak out in a certain way. And usually, as I'm sure we'll talk about today, this is, polling is the world of two things can be true at the same time on, you know, times a million. Lots of different contradictory things can be true at the same time. Because if you've ever talked to an actual voter, and I don't say this as a negative thing about actual voters, but people just generally hold contradictory things in their own minds at the same time. I think you're going to see a lot of this when we get into talking about how people feel on tariffs, et cetera. I mean, just for one very contemporary example, but never just use one data point as the thing that explains everything.
Right.
There are usually a couple different data points that will provide additional context and nuance. And that's where you find the real value in the data.
Right. And appreciating that voters aren't thinking about this stuff as deeply as you are.
Very much so. Very much so.
Yeah.
And it's not because voters are dumb. I mean, I hear that from other political consultants sometimes. Not to say, I mean, some voters are aggressively and intentionally very checked out, but I think that people who work in this industry, we are exposed to a day-to-day drip, drip, drip of, can you believe the White House did this? Oh my gosh, this person in Congress did this. Did you know what happened in this country? And for people for whom this is not their profession, they thankfully, for them, maybe checking in with this much less often. And so it is interesting to me what breaks through, what things that cause a stir in this town also cause a stir in people outside of this town.
Right.
But I think that's also a really important role that polling plays, is we are being a good listener to people outside of our own bubbles.
And you do focus groups as well. And you and Margie O'Meara, who used to host a podcast together. I miss the Pollsters podcast.
I do too.
If you ever want to bring it back. Talk about how focus groups intersect with just the hard data numbers that you're getting from survey research.
So what I think focus groups do is they provide color and texture, and they also give people, when conducted correctly, a chance to sort of give you what's on their mind without it being sort of forced out of them through the act of taking a survey.
Right.
So that is why, for instance, you know, when I do a focus group of, you know, voters who maybe voted for Donald Trump and we want to understand why, in a survey, it would be very easy for a pollster to say, is it because of the economy? Is it because he's strong? Is it because he's decisive? You know, things that people, you know, that you could consider positive attributes. But it's in a focus group where all of a sudden you notice 4 out of the 8 participants have specifically mentioned Donald Trump putting his fist in the air after he gets shot at the Butler rally. And you go, ah, like, I don't know if a survey would have captured the way that moment and that image is driving this attribute that they attribute to Trump. So, now I've got an additional layer of information that helps me understand the poll better or think better what kind of poll question to write.
Okay. So with all of that in mind, let's dive into the data. And as I said at the outset, we're about 100 days in now to Donald Trump's second term. What are you seeing? And is there anything that's surprising to you?
I think for me, when I compare Donald Trump's poll standing now to where he was 8 years ago, there are a couple of things that stand out that if I'm the White House are giving me some pause. There's a lot of talk about, you know, I think Pew just put out a poll very recently. They did their sort of first 100 days check-in. And they said correctly that, you know, Donald Trump's job approval, I think they have it at 40%. That's the lowest they've had for a president at this stage of their presidency on record. And that seems like it's a warning sign. For me, that actually would not be freaking me out if I'm the White House, because we have seen over the last few decades declines in the existence of a honeymoon. You know, declines in the existence of the ability to get to 60% job approval, no matter what. So like 40% is the new 50%. That number in and of itself, not necessarily a problem. What I do think has been really striking to me is when you look at Trump's job approval on two different issues, immigration and the economy, and how they look so different under the hood. So Donald Trump's first term as president was characterized by this gap between approval of him overall and approval on the economy, where you had some segment of voters who said, you know what? I don't like the guy. I don't like his tweets. I don't like the way he's running things, but I do think the economy is going well. I've got more money in my pocket. He's a businessman. At least he's good at this one thing. So when you start looking at the numbers now and you see that his job approval on the economy is below his job approval overall, that's a pretty big inversion of what used to be his big strength. And the thing that to me makes it the most striking is when you look at the intensity of approval. So when we ask job approval, we don't just ask, do you approve or disapprove? We then ask people, would you say that's strongly or just somewhat? And that can tell you something too. Because Donald Trump is known for having really strong support from his core base of voters. But when I look at the crosstabs of my most recent survey, we looked at people who voted for Donald Trump. So that's not necessarily just the MAGA base. There are plenty of people that voted for Donald Trump who think he's fine, but he was better than Kamala Harris. You know, they're not like wearing red hats necessarily, but they are Trump voters. When I look at Trump voter attitudes about what he's doing on immigration, his job approval on immigration there is through the roof, and it is intense. Almost three quarters of voters who voted for Donald Trump say that they strongly approve of what he's doing on immigration. And bear in mind, this survey was in the field post all of this El Salvador stuff that is causing a lot of outrage, these clashes with the court. They're aware of that. And they're going, yes, we like it, which is why I think you're seeing Donald Trump not back down an inch from any of this. But when we ask about the economy and we look at that same group of Trump voters, instead of it being 74% strong approve, it's 53% strong approve. That's not a terrible number, but wow, does that gap tell us something? It means that his ride or die folks, they see what he's doing with gutting the administrative state or mass deportation, and they're like, yeah, that's awesome. And then they look at the economy and they're like, that's the thing that you're supposed to be really good at. And I'm not sure it feels like it's going so good. And there was, you know, you mentioned focus groups. Margie, my former podcast co-host, she did the most recent one for The Times, and she got to talk to Trump voters. And she asked them all, you know, how are you feeling about things? And the biggest concern was, I get that he likes tariffs, and I think he has some kind, I think he's got a reason why, but I don't really see where this is going. And it feels like it's creating turbulence. I feel like stuff's not getting cheaper. Where is this all going? And that came up kind of unprompted. Now, the good news for the White House is twofold. One is all of those focus group voters still said if they were given the chance today, they'd vote for Trump again. So it's not as though he has alienated his voters enough to where there's like true buyer's remorse happening, but they're starting to ask questions and say, where's this all going? The other thing that Donald Trump really has going for him is that his opposition is viewed as worse on a host of fronts. In that Pew poll that came out, they put, you know, they send out their press release with like, here's all the different bullet points. And it's like, bad number for Trump, bad number for Trump, bad number for Trump, bad number for Trump. And the last bullet is like, but Republicans are more trusted. It was either Republicans are more trusted than Democrats, or it was that the party ID, like more people identified or were favorable toward the Republican Party than toward the Democratic Party. And so he benefits from the fact that right now voters are not exactly flocking to his alternatives.
Well, Kristen, let's walk through that because you're right. For that first term, there were always those voters who said, I don't really like him, but I like the job that he's doing on the economy. And yet there were plenty of people who also said, I like the job he's doing on the economy, but I can never vote for him, right? Mm-hmm. How do we get a sense, just looking at that economy number as a sort of barometer of his strength or weakness as a political, you know, as a political leader mm-hmm. of the Republican Party? As we're thinking through, obviously he can't run again, but as we're thinking through what it means for the party as we're going into a midterm, like how is that the way that people think about Trump handling the economy? How does that filter down to voters' perceptions of the party overall as they go to the ballot box a year from now, a year and a half from now?
So in normal, in normal times, if you have a president who, for whatever reason, is becoming more and more unpopular, you would expect to see folks in Congress try to put forward their own unique, distinct message, try to distance themselves, I'm not like those other Republicans. I'm a cool Republican, whatever it is. And I just think that dynamic is so much harder now because Donald Trump doesn't let you have an alternative message. Donald Trump is the message.
Right.
And I think enough Republicans have been either they've really just come around to saying, look, this is the only guy on our side who can win. So it seems crazy, but I'm in for it. Or they fear that, you know what, we've declared Donald Trump politically dead before, and that zombie always comes back. You know, we thought he was gone after January 6th, and he came back, and we thought he might have been gone after the indictments and the convictions, and he was not gone. And so I'm not crossing him. I'm not distancing myself from him because that never turns out well for Republicans who do that. So I think you are unlikely to see Republicans, like they're all in. Like
you're attached, right? So this tariff thing works out. It doesn't work out. They have very little, even though we know they actually have incredible power as a member of Congress to do something about these tariffs, right? They can actually stand up and say, no, we're going to take our constitutional power back and we're going to say, nope, we're passing legislation stopping these tariffs. But to your point, if they do that, there's a bigger risk in angering the base.
Well, I also wonder if the lack of congressional action is not the same as Congress doing something people don't like. Like, I do think that it's harder to run an ad that says, don't vote for this person. They could have stopped Trump and didn't, versus don't vote for this person. Look at this horrible bill they voted for, or look at this horrible vote they took. The absence of a vote, I do think, is harder to message on. But like right now, Republicans, they are perfectly happy for this to be the Donald Trump show. Again, they think he's the one that has figured out the winning formula. He knows something about how to do this that we don't. So we're in for him. One question that we have asked in our surveys going back to March of 2020 was, if you are a Republican in our survey, we ask you, do you think of yourself more as a supporter of Donald Trump or as a supporter of the Republican Party? And back then, it was leaning slightly more toward Donald Trump, but it was a presidential year. We were a nation in crisis. Like, that kind of makes sense. You get through the 2020 election and he loses and people begin to flee the Donald Trump ship. I'm just a Republican. I'm not a Donald Trump supporter. After January 6th, that the number of Republicans saying I'm a MAGA Trump supporter first craters. It falls to like 25%. And then it just kind of simmers there pretty low throughout 2021 into 2022. Then you get into 2023 and you start having talk of these indictments, raid on Mar-a-Lago, like all of these things start happening. And you can just see in the numbers, the wagon circle. And Republicans are like, nope, they're coming after him and he's my guy. So I'm back in on him. And now when we ask that question, it is like a 2-to-1 margin. Republicans saying they think of themselves as a Trump supporter first, rather than a Republican Party supporter. So the fate of the party is so bound up in Donald Trump right now. And the problem Republicans have is that Donald Trump has created a coalition for the party that's very good for Donald Trump. It is voters who love Donald Trump, or they're pretty checked out of politics, but when he's on a ballot, they're more than happy to show up. But when he is not on a ballot, they're not necessarily like, go GOP. And that's why some of these special elections, I suspect, have been so grisly or going to be so grisly, that just the new Republican coalition is not made up of the people who go out to vote in assistant dog catcher elections. Those folks have become the Democrats now. Yep. Republicans have a big, wide base of people who vote when Donald Trump is there, but they don't turn out otherwise. And I think that is a pretty significant challenge for the party.
I think that's an excellent point. And obviously, as we're coming into a midterm election, that is going to be something we're all paying very, very close attention to about this new coalition and how engaged they are. But Chrissy, do you think that essentially then, if you're Donald Trump, you're looking at these numbers on the economy and immigration, as you pointed out, that it's worth going all in on immigration? Or is there also a risk that that's an overreach, in the sense that the people who voted for you last time around not necessarily because of immigration, though maybe they liked it, but really it was, I want him to lower prices. The economy is not working for me. That is something that either turns them off, they don't like what he's doing, or they feel like he's talking about something that isn't the top issue for me.
So I think it really goes back to the question of what do you think voters voted for Donald Trump to do? And I have no doubt that members of his core base, the people who would have voted for him no matter what, are saying, close the border, fix immigration. And I also have no doubt that a lot of those voters in the center who may not love Donald Trump were nevertheless persuaded in part by the fact that they felt like immigration had gotten out of control and maybe Donald Trump's the guy to fix it.
Yep.
So I still think it is an issue that is playing in his favor. However, there's also the question of what are you focusing on? And even if the actions he is taking on immigration are generally still popular with the people who voted for him, I still think the number one issue is the number one issue. And the number one issue for the voters who were the most kind of on the bubble is cost of living, is Bidenflation, is all of that. And so that's why I think if it becomes, it's less risky that his voters will suddenly decide, please stop deporting people. I really think, I mean, you could get to a place where there are more sympathetic situations and so on, but right now that is not what has emerged or what I am seeing in the data. However, if there is a sense that he is just not focused on the right issue, I mean, that has created political peril for presidents forever. You can look at what was George W. Bush reelected to do in 2004. Arguably, he was reelected to keep America safe and make the Iraq war go better. And then he decides, I'm going to use that political capital to reform Social Security. That wasn't the number one issue. That wasn't what people voted for him to do. And so even though that may have been a good policy on the merits, it wasn't something that was going to help him. You look at Barack Obama, voted to fix the economy. Okay, so you do the stimulus, but then you start getting into the Affordable Care Act. Well, wait a minute. Is that what voters voted for you to do? Becomes wildly unpopular as it passes and gives Republicans an opportunity to win 60 some odd seats in the House. Even Biden, I would argue, I've sort of described it as Americans in Trump's first term felt like they were on a plane that was going through turbulence. And they were like, I would really like to get to smooth air, please. And Biden's like, smooth air, I've got you. And then he becomes president and people start going, is there someone in the cockpit? Are we sure there's a pilot? And suddenly, like, at least knowing you have a pilot when you're going through turbulence, maybe that seems appealing. Like, maybe let's go back to that. You know, that Biden was elected to bring about stability and instead, from my view, this is maybe me putting on my little bit of a Republican hat, like pursued an agenda that was sort of to the left of and not necessarily directly what people had elected him to do. And it led to a little bit more chaos, more instability, paved the way for Donald Trump to come back. So every president who gets elected or reelected has this question.
Yeah, they always overthink their mandate, right?
Yes.
Overread it.
If I were to say that there's something Trump is doing, though, that I think may be a greater threat on that front, it might be some of the DOGE stuff. And if that is sort of calming down and Elon Musk is stepping back, that may all begin to fade a little bit from the public consciousness. But the like gutting of the administrative state and the taking on of, quote, big government and bureaucracy is something that's been on Republican wish lists for so long. Like, that's not just a Trump thing. And so you would find, I would find Republicans all throughout this town who don't even like Trump, but were like, yes, I kind of love it. But is that what voters voted for Donald Trump to do? I think there are some questions about how far they actually wanted him to cut. You know, is he getting muscle and bone here when they're doing some of these cuts? Are they going to affect things that really tangibly matter to people in their daily lives? That's when you can begin to see the political wheels fall off of some of that.
A quick break. We'll be back with Kristen Soltis Anderson. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governors, the House, and the Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But it's only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD, that's ODD, the number 10,
to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers.
You hear Democrats talking about this term chaos, to your point, that the turbulence, right? When you get Donald Trump, you get chaos, you get turbulence. Maybe you do want to see some of these things shaken up, but he's doing it in a way that is so disruptive that it's actually destroying rather than making it stronger. And then I also sit into these focus groups, Kristen, like you do, and I'll hear people grappling with that, right? Well, they'll say, well, at least he's doing something. Joe Biden didn't do anything. This guy, every day he's doing something. And I heard one, it was a group of Latino men, and one of them said, I really like what he's doing. Like, yeah, cut the Department of Education. I don't know that I love the tariffs, right? So they're trying to grapple with, I like that he's active. I like every day he's going and doing something. But like, what is this going to be? So how are you thinking through at what point voters really come to a conclusion about whether this is good or not good?
I think that he is asking his voters to say, you need to weather a little bit of short-term pain, but yep, I promise there will be long-term gain. And I've seen in a lot of data that among voters who are leaning more pro-Trump, somewhat open to tariffs, that there's really not a ton of support for tariffs as tariffs. Right. Like there's not a lot of Peter Navarroism I'm seeing in the data.
No, they think they're going to be, all the data that I see too, that these are short term, that he's using this for leverage. He's using this to make better deals. This isn't going to be like a forever thing. This is just art of the deal.
Yeah. Or it might be okay if it's like a little bit painful, but in the end, it means we've got factories opening all over and we're getting back to making things in America again. And I do think that there's a little bit of a worry from some of these voters, like, what happens if we get to Christmas? The factory in my town that closed a decade ago is not back open, but I have to buy my kids fewer Christmas presents. Right. And that's like the worst case scenario. You've gotten all the downsides of a tariff, but none of that good stuff has materialized. Because I think even best case scenario for this aggressive trade policy, you're not going to see if these supposed or promised benefits necessarily popping up really fast. And so how much pain can you weather before the factories all reopen? That, I think he's set up a very tough situation for himself and his own party. But I think he's also responsive to it. You know, there are times where he does things and people scream that it's unpopular and it's outrageous and how could he do this? And he just doesn't care. But he did blink on Liberation Day, and his voters will follow him on his path. Like, this idea that he has to double down and he has to do it or his voters are going to see him as weak, I don't think is true. We went into the field the day after Liberation Day, after he had proposed and then backed off the tariffs when the market went haywire. And we asked people, which statement best describes your view? Donald Trump should never have proposed tariffs in the first place. Donald Trump was right to propose tariffs, but also right to suspend them to see if he can get better deals. Donald Trump was right to propose the tariffs, and he should have stuck with them. And like almost no one is in that camp. Even among Republicans, only 10% of our respondents were in the like, nope, pedal to the metal. Why are we letting up on this? You had 7 in 10 Republicans who were like, I'm willing to believe there's a strategy here. Right. I don't understand it, but I'm willing to believe that there's a plan. Right. And then you had another, you know, 20% of the party that was like, I don't think he should have done this in the first place. I think this is crazy and stupid. But nevertheless, you still had 7 in 10 that were like, okay, let's see where this is going. Like, they are still playing wait and see.
Well, and that, Kristen, seems to be the challenge even that Biden had, which he was so excited about the infrastructure bill, right? All he wanted to talk about is like, we're going to get all these jobs back, right? We're going to be building roads and bridges and the CHIPS Act. And look, we're going to have an Intel factory here in Ohio, and we're going to be doing all this stuff. And voters were like, okay, cool, but my grocery bill is outrageous. What are you doing about that? So are we going to get back into that mold too, Kristen, where it's like, okay, that's great. Make America great again. Build the factories. Get American manufacturing. but I really can't afford my rent. I really wanted prices to come down, and I don't feel like you're addressing that enough.
Yeah, I think that the short-term pain for long-term gain is just, it's always tough politics.
Yeah.
Look at how many times people have attempted things like, well, there haven't actually been that many times. I take it back. But something like entitlement reform. It'll be short-term pain, but it's for the long-term gain of the fiscal health of the country, those sorts of things. Mm-mm. It's just tough politics. And the other thing that he's doing is not just asking voters endure some short-term pain for some sort of vague, unclear long-term gain, but he's also making his own party and asking them, his own members, stick with me. Short-term political pain. Some people might yell at you in some town halls, but long-term people are going to see that we're right and it's going to be a benefit to our party over the long haul. And that's just also a hard thing to ask, especially when you've got these folks in the House that are up for election every 2 years. And if he was not Donald Trump with the unique personal power and hold he has over the Republican voter base, it would be much harder for him to navigate that ask.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, watching those town halls in 2009 and 10, where Democrats, of course, were getting yelled at about Obamacare. And it was, you're going to stick with this vote and it's probably going to cost you your seat. But you can look back at that vote today and say, hey, I did the right thing, right? You'll be able to, historically, you're doing the right thing. And for some people who are members of Congress are willing to say, I'd rather do the right thing and take the political hit. But politicians also are famous for not wanting to take a political hit.
But also, at least with the Affordable Care Act, I think part of the reason why, when I've been asking my Democratic friends, if you could go back in time and warn all of those members who are about to walk the plank for Nancy Pelosi to get this bill across the finish line, tell them how this is going to turn out. Tell them that you are going to lose a Senate seat in Massachusetts because people are going to hate this so much. Do you go back and send that warning? Or do you just like let them walk the plank now knowing what you know? And 100%, I don't try to discourage people from voting for this bill. In the end, we know it's a good bill. In the end, it's all going to be fine. And I think that's fascinating. With the tariffs, the question is, what's that end game, right? Democrats had been wanting to remake the healthcare system for a long time.
Right.
Republicans have not been wanting to remake global trade for a long time. The tariffs thing is a little bit newer, again, which is why you don't find a huge number of Republicans who are genuinely diehard tariff fans. They're genuinely diehard Trump fans. And because Trump likes tariffs, it's like the transitive property. Okay, well, he likes them and I like him, so I guess I like them. That's not the same as the party like craving tariffs.
Right. And yet, tariffs are wrapped into this broader concept of what does it mean to be a, what does the MAGA party mean? And essentially it means bringing America back to a place where we did stuff, manufactured stuff, produced stuff in the country. And whether that comes from closing, right? And it's in every piece of his agenda, closing borders, the way in which we are interacting with the world, with foreign aid, and now with tariffs, it all is leading to the same place. And I guess that's the question, Kristen, because he has certainly remade the Republican Party. There's no doubt about that in his image. But it seems as if he has remade the Democratic Party as well, right? Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So talk to us a little bit about that. We always hear about, well, where does the Republican Party go post-Trump? Well, where does the Democratic Party go post-Trump? I don't know the answer to that.
So one, you're right. Donald Trump is excellent at moving voters and not only his own voters, but now suddenly like the Democratic Party just like hates tariffs. Like they think tariffs are terrible. It's kind of fascinating. Everything Donald Trump touches, just immediate like polarization happens. Yep. So what's happening on the Democratic side, I think, is going to be fascinating because, so think about all the reasons you just gave for why something like tariffs is so core to Trump's message. The idea that like America's been getting screwed. We've been too nice to the rest of the world and nobody's grateful to us for it. We don't make things here anymore. We've let the rest of the world eat our lunch.
Yep.
And what is the Democrats' answer to that? If the answer is like, no, we haven't been getting treated unfairly by the rest of the world. Like, that's kind of a hard message. No, it's fine that we don't make these things in America. That's kind of a hard message. And so this question of like being in the spot of defending the status quo is a really hard place for Democrats to be when you have the, you know, I'm going to be a check and balance on the president. I'm going to be the brake pedal. He's the gas pedal, but I'm going to be the brake pedal. If they think he's driving out of control, that can be a good message. But if you are seen as I'm defending the status quo, where America is being treated unfairly, where we're not making things here, where, you know, country X is putting a 50% tariff on our dairy or a 100% tariff on our cars, and that's not fair. So why don't we get to fight back? It's tough. What's the Democratic message? And I think it is notable that you now have, you know, Bernie and AOC going around the country doing these big rallies, doing them in places like Idaho. They're not just sticking to like safe blue territory. They're really trying to build this progressive populist movement. There are ways in which this feels a little like 2009, 2010, you know, beginnings of the Tea Party movement. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party sort of looking at like, how did we lose? We lost this election. Where do we go from here? There's now this progressive president in office and we need to react. And they begin to organize themselves. There's frustration with Republican leadership. They're too weak. They're not doing anything. That eventually turns into this Tea Party movement that ultimately kind of consumes the party. You know, Donald Trump really co-opts it, makes it his own, and he becomes the party. So can populism on the Democratic side do the same thing? And I think there are a couple things that are different about the dynamics on the Democratic side that mean the Tea Party analogy isn't perfectly the same. Like, yes, you have people angrily showing up at town halls, much like you did in 2010. Yes, you have people, voters increasingly agitated with what they view as in like an outdated leadership model. They're too weak. They're giving in too much, you know, echoes of what you hear Democrats voters now saying about someone like Chuck Schumer. However, a core difference here is that we oftentimes use the words activist and base interchangeably. Oh, what do the party activists want? What does the party base want? And on the Democratic side, those are not the same thing. The activists, the folks who run the groups who sort of demand very progressive issue, you know, fealty on very progressive issue grounds, and you know, my issue is linked to your issue, and you've got to be perfect on all of these, and no, I don't want a big tent that lets these hateful bigot people in. You know, like that's the activist view for sure. But the Democratic base is not those people. The Democratic base is more moderate, normie, you know, baby boomer African Americans in the Atlanta suburbs, right? Like it's not the same. Their activists and their base are not the same. And so that may well be a moderating force in their party. And it may well be why on the Republican side, you started to see like, you know, conservative Tea Party challengers taking out establishment candidates. And that like it's been a little bit slower going on the Democratic side. It hasn't caught fire as much. And it's because their primary electorate is not the same as activists in the way that Republicans' primary electorate really was kind of in line with where the activists were. So that's slowing things down. The last thing I'll say on this is like Democratic voters are really mad. And the best thing they have going for them going into this midterm is that there's this emotional asymmetry. Democratic voters are furious and Republican voters are like, things are good. And that's not the same level of intensity. You always want the more intense emotion on your side. The other thing that is going to be interesting is we have asked Democratic voters, do you wish that your party leadership was finding more ways to compromise and get things done? Or do you wish your party leadership was being more combative and confrontational and obstructing Donald Trump's agenda more? And Democrats choose the latter. But then when you say, do you think your party needs to move to the left, move to the middle, or stay about where it is, far more say move to the center than say move to the left. So there is a separation between temperament and ideology that I also think is interesting. That on the Republican side, fight, fight, fight also was expected. Like you need to be a fighter who is also pairing this with this conservative ideological purity. And on the Democratic side, it may just be the act of being combative and forceful and energetic post Joe Biden and post, you know, the kind of rough campaign that Harris, wound up running that I don't know how many, you know, I think most Democrats that I see in my data don't necessarily blame her for the way the election went, but nevertheless, like they're looking for vigor and energy. They're not necessarily looking for a pivot to socialism. And so whether Democrats can strike that balance, I think will be interesting.
I think that's exactly right. That's an incredibly smart insight. And when I listened to a recent AOC speech out in California, what you notice is, yes, some of the same things come up about, you know, we do need to have better healthcare so everybody in this country is covered and things like that. But that's not the meat of the speech. The meat of the speech is this idea that, much like Donald Trump, right, the system is rigged. The system is rigged against you. If Donald Trump's saying the system's rigged against you by the elites and by the woke left, she's saying the system's rigged against you by the billionaires and the, you know, the sycophants to Donald Trump. And the system has been in place long before Donald Trump. And what needs to change is the system, not just Donald Trump. But it's not as overtly liberal left. We need to institute a sort of socialist answer, right? That will be the answer to what our economic agenda will literally be, the socialist answer to Donald Trump's vision of the economy. So you're right. It seems much more that they're trying to thread the needle maybe on this. I don't know. Recognizing that being a socialist is not going to get you victory for president of the United States in America.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was notable. I saw a clip circulating from that Idaho rally that people were saying had echoes of Obama in it, that like she all but said, we love our gay friends in the red states and we worship an awesome God in the blue states. Like it was like very adjacent to that. And like, I think that's not without reason.
I think so too. And the question, you know, can she really truly rebrand herself is going to be fascinating. You know, if you watch enough campaign ads as I do, AOC ends up in a lot of Republican attack ads, right? She mm-hmm. is the image of the left and the things that, what Republicans see and hope that swing voters see as going a step too far. But I think you're right, this idea, and that's sort of where I want to end things here, Kristen, is sort of where we began with trying to understand how complicated voters are. But just as we're talking about things like the base and the strategy, talk about how our politics now, we in the media and in people who cover campaigns like to talk about there's a progressive wing and a conservative wing. And this it's just this nice spectrum. And you fit somewhere as a voter, you fit somewhere on there. But our politics increasingly, that spectrum is, it's a mess, right? So how do you explain where this country, when we talk about the divide and the polarization in this country, it's not really ideology, is it? Policy?
It's not. So we've been doing this fun question or series of questions for the last couple of years where every summer we do one survey where we devote a big section to asking people for their views on 10 different policy, economic policy type questions, size of government, taxes, that kind of stuff. And then 10 questions on social and cultural, which so that's a wide range of things. You know, from immigration to race, gender, all of that. And then we give people a score based on like how strongly they agree with certain statements or disagree. And if you are like, I'm all in, strongly agreeing with all the conservative positions on everything, then when we plot you out on this chart, you're up in like the top right corner. And if you are all the liberal positions on everything strongly, you're down in the bottom left corner. And very few people are in that bucket. I think it's only like, you know, 1 in 6 wind up being pretty darn conservative on most things, you know, 13% on the liberal side. There's a ton of voters that are in the middle that are choosing a little of column A and column B. But the reason why I remain so bullish on somebody like an AOC for the Democratic side or J.D. Vance for the Republican side, and why I still think this populist moment is a really big deal and not going anywhere, is when we look at which voters fall into the, like, I'm more socially fiscally conservative, but socially progressive. we find that's only a small handful of voters.
Right. And they all live in the DC media market.
It's all my friends. But then there's this huge group of people who are very open to a robust role for government, even as they are a little bit more, they're not all in on the progressive social stuff. And it seems to me that AOC is waking up on that in the same way that J.D. Vance on the Republican side sort of has woken, you know, seemed very well aware, as did Donald Trump. There's a lot of people that vote Republican that could not care less about free markets and like carried interest and, you know, those sorts of things. And so is the future of the party recapturing that like Mike Bloombergian view of the center, or is it like fish where the fish are? There's a lot of fish in that more populist type pool. And it seems to me that both AOC and J.D. Vance have the instinct to know like that's where there are more voters that may be available to me.
Right. Kristen Soltis Anderson, fantastic conversation. Thank you for taking all this time with me.
Thank you for having me.
You've got a busy schedule, but we will talk soon.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.